Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We're thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Aubrey Paris. Aubrey's a policymaker, producer, author, podcaster, and PhD scientist who most recently served as a senior policy advisor in the Secretary of State's Office of Global Women's Issues at the U.S. Department of State. In that role, she was responsible for leading the department's diplomatic and strategic efforts related to the nexus of women's rights and climate change. Separately, she's a content creator who leads National Treasure Hunt, the podcast, books, walking tour, and community event series examining the National Treasure film franchise through an interdisciplinary lens. And honestly, everything you do is interdisciplinary, right, Aubrey?
I try to make it that way.
It's a way of life. So I'm not even going to pretend that I don't know you, because my listeners will not be fooled. You are a respected scientist, a gifted communicator, brilliant strategist, and you have seemingly limitless energy and inspiration. Plus, you're a very good friend of mine, and you've been podcasting for a decade longer than I have, so in theory, I should be very intimidated, but
No, of course not.
We're buddies, and we both want to make foreign policy cool and relatable, so let's dive right in and get it done. Aubrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this conversation literally all week.
Well, I've been looking forward to this conversation for like years, because I feel like from the moment that we met, I was like, one day we're going to record something. Our chats were just too entertaining. So now we're finally doing it.
I miss those lunches. We had some great lunch conversations, that's for sure.
I know, we did. All right, so let's go back to the very beginning. And you tell me and our listeners, where did you grow up and what was your childhood like?
So I am from New Jersey, South Jersey specifically, like 20 minutes outside of Philadelphia, we're talking. When people are familiar with New Jersey, I usually point them towards like Cherry Hill as the general area. And that tends to ring a bell. I'm not really sure why, but...
It does ring a bell. You said Cherry Hill, and I was like, ah, got it, Cherry Hill.
There we go. Okay, see, there we go. That's the area I grew up in. I went to Delran High School, local high school, public school, had an interesting experience. I always felt that my high school experience was like kind of out of the movie Mean Girls. I thought that was normal, and then learned in college later that that wasn't everyone's normal high school experience. But I don't know. I like to say that movies are based off of my life.
And to be clear for our listeners, you were definitely not one of the mean girls.
I don't think I was. I was definitely one of the more outcast girls. I don't know which of the lunch tables and Mean Girls I would have sat at. But that's where I grew up. I played a lot of sports. I was very involved in like highly competitive softball, a tournament travel team for most of my childhood. Didn't actually really like it very much, but I did it for my dad. I also played soccer and tennis and did a lot of horseback riding.
Oh my gosh, and you were an only child. So you're like the object of all of your parents' like hopes and dreams, right?
Yeah, my dad likes to say that I was the son he never had, because I became a huge baseball fan, still am to this day, San Francisco Giants all the way. But yes, I became the person that the parents' hobbies were tested on, for sure.
Yeah. And what did your parents do?
So my mom was a public school teacher, in a middle school. She started teaching math and science. So I kind of grew up with that, very heavily in my younger years. And then she switched over to like ancient civilizations and history. And then my dad, he worked at Lockheed Martin for basically his whole career full time, but he got involved in local politics when I was in middle school, and then ended up serving as the mayor of my town for, I think, 14 years in the end.
Okay. This is amazing, because as public service origin stories go, like I usually can see a thread between how people were raised and like what inspired them or what was the spark for them. And going back to the fact that everything you do is interdisciplinary, I mean, I just jotted down this note like, okay, so your parents were about like science, history, politics, defense and security. And you're like, I'll roll that into one job. No problem. I'm going to go and do that.
You know, you're the first person who's ever like made that connection to me. And I don't even know that I fully made that connection myself. But in retrospect, you're exactly right. I don't think they ever expected me to land at the State Department. Frankly, I don't know that I expected to land at the State Department. But in retrospect, if we're looking at influences, I definitely had a lot of strong ones.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so cool. So how did you end up becoming a scientist?
Well, I was the science fair kid, like since science fairs started in middle school. Was influenced by my sixth grade science teacher, Mr. Parente, who got me into science fair from the jump. And then every year, so like in the beginning, it was required to do science fair. And then it became like completely optional. You'd get extra credit. And most people who did it for the extra credit. I did it because it was like a sport to me. especially by the time I got to high school, I got really into the like environmental science type projects and did things on like oil spills and soil erosion and many other things that I don't even remember now. But I got really competitive in that, always really enjoyed science, was always good at it. And when I went to college, I went to a liberal arts school. There's some interdisciplinary for you. I went to Ursinus College outside of Philly and had the most wonderful experience. Ended up double majoring in chemistry and biology, minoring in French and science and the common good. Did a summer research experience at UC Berkeley. Between my junior and senior year, which helped me realize that grad school was a thing. And then a very influential Ursinus professor for me, Dr. Fennig, who was the one who convinced me to be a chemist. I had no intention of majoring in chemistry when I went to college. He and the Berkeley program kind of convinced me that, well, the next thing you do in the sciences is go to grad school and get a PhD. So I guess that's what's happening next. And I ended up at Princeton doing my PhD in chemistry and materials science. So as I'm telling my story, I'm realizing I'm just highly suggestible, I think, and just like going where people tell me is what I should be doing is where I land, I guess.
But then you go and you do it in a way that no one else would do it, which is what I really love about you.
Oh, thank you. That's a huge compliment, especially coming from you. And I'm cool with being known as that. You know what I mean? Like taking something more traditional and kind of turning it on its head.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I feel like science and the common good is a class that I could have gotten behind. I was like the kid that barely passed all my science classes, and my science teachers were like, "You're not dumb. Like, what's wrong with you?" And I'm like, I hate it so much.
Okay, here's the thing. Not ever. The left brain, right brain thing is definitely real, but it's also, I think people look at it as very siloed and like you're either one or the other. I don't think that's necessarily true, but people do have preferences and they learn better in certain formats. And the way we teach certain subjects is just not conducive to everyone's way of thinking. Do I think there are ways to teach science to people who are more artistically minded? Absolutely. We just don't do it that way. Yeah. But you mentioned the science and the common good piece. That was extremely influential to me. And to this day, I like to tell people, I think I ended up at the State Department doing the work that I did because of Ursinus, because of the science and the common good program. Yeah. Ursinus is known as a pre-med school. Like there's a lot of science majors and a lot of them go off to be doctors. I knew I didn't want to be a doctor, but I was interested in science more on the research and the and the applied side. And it was through lecturers, like visiting guests, internships, etc., through that Science and the Common Good program that I was introduced to two topics that have driven my career. And those are science policy and science communication. And those, once I realized those existed, it was kind of a flashing light of like, this is what you're supposed to do if you want to put into practice your belief that science loses so much of its meaning and impact if it can't be effectively translated to benefit the lives of people.
Yeah. And that's really powerful because I think you're showing us how like, there are so many different topics that you can become an expert in, but it's all about how you bring like your skills and experience to bear to then make the most out of that. And you've totally done that. And so then you did end up at the Department of State. And I love the fact that these lectures and like guest speakers were so impactful for you because you're right. Like if you can see it, you can be it. But if you've never seen it, you have no idea. So tell me how you ended up at the Department of State, because I know that you weren't just like sitting around as a young scientist, like I will reach the Department of State one day. How did it happen for you?
Yeah, I remember telling you, and I've told multiple people, I didn't know what the State Department was growing up. I don't think I had heard of it before. Like I had heard of the Secretary of State, but didn't really know what that person did or where they sat. And when I, even the people around me, like friends and family, when I eventually told them I was going to the State Department, the first reaction was typically, oh, what state? And mm-hmm. I say that to say that, like, I don't think the general public has a consistent understanding of what the State Department does. And I definitely fell within that camp and yet still was able to go there and do what I think was very impactful work in an effective way. So I ended up at State through one of the, they're called Science and Technology Policy Fellowship Programs, yeah, or STPF. And these are basically programs that take PhD scientists and place them in assignments within the federal government for 1 to 2 year stints. Typically, the fellowships are used by young scientists, like young PhDs, to figure out if they want a career pivot into policy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes there are tenured professors who do it for a sabbatical to take some, you know, learnings back with them to university, or sometimes for a career pivot late stage themselves. And so just by sheer happenstance, I ended up, honestly, it's like a logistics snafu in a way, because the way these policy fellowship programs, like their application cycles work, you had to have your degree in hand by the time you were applying for the majority of these fellowship programs. And okay. I was really adamant about not taking a gap year or anything like that. And so that limited the programs I could apply mm-hmm. to. And so the only programs I could apply to were like two that sent people to the State Department and like a bunch that would send people to Congress. And between Congress and the executive branch, I felt more drawn to the executive branch just because I felt like, I don't know, I didn't have the best perception or of what Congress did or like mm-hmm. that they were terribly effective. So I was like, let's try the other one. I got one of the fellowships for State and there I was. I started in the Office of the Science and Technology Advisor to the Secretary. So makes some sense with my background. Yeah. I was assigned portfolios related to biotech policy as well as public diplomacy, which was great because for those who aren't familiar, public diplomacy is basically the State Department's fancy way of saying like outreach and communication, particularly yeah. to foreign audiences. And I was like, great, science communication all the way. And so I did that job for about a year and a half, and then moved over at the transition between the Trump and Biden administrations to the Secretary's Office of Global Women's Issues, where they brought me over specifically to create a new portfolio on the nexus of gender equality and climate change.
Which is so cool, because who's better equipped to create something new at the nexus of intersecting issues than you? And so I met you when you were in that role. And I also have to add, some of my like quickest, most natural friendships at the State Department were with scientists, because I feel like a lot of scientists were coming in often for these fellowships, which are like temporary unless you convert into a full-time position. And we kind of just saw in each other like, are you sort of an outsider? Yeah, me too. Mm. Like, we're new to this game and we're here to see what we can do. And we know that we have an opportunity now that we're here to add something new to the conversation. So maybe that's why we clicked initially. And then I discovered that you were one of the coolest people I've ever known. And so please tell us a little bit about what you did when you were at the department, when you were tasked with kind of standing up this new portfolio and what that work was all about.
Yeah. So it was such a unique experience because, I mean, you know this, Kate, as someone who spent time at State yourself, it's really hard to find a situation where you get to build a new plane and make it fly, right? Mm-hmm. To use an analogy. Most of the time you're coming into an office, the plane is already flying and your job is to make sure it keeps going and doesn't hit the ground. Right. There's work that's already established and you're just kind of jumping on board. At some point, you'll probably jump off and someone else will jump on. And while I could have done that work just fine, that's not really what drives me. I've always had kind of an entrepreneurial mindset. And so this gender climate work was such an incredible opportunity for me that fit in line with my interests. I was deeply passionate about climate change, mm-hmm. all the research that I focused on from science fair, doing those environmental projects in high school, all the way up through my PhD, where my research was focused on transforming carbon dioxide into useful or marketable products for climate change mitigation. It's always been centered around climate and the environment. And so that was a great fit. And then on the women's issues side, I'll be honest, just like I've never taken a class in international relations or political science, I'd never taken a women's studies course. And so my passion for the women's work was really coming from personal experiences as a woman scientist. And having tons of stories of just being treated differently or, you know, not believed because don't know, I guess I have a face that says you don't know what you're talking about. So it was.
But now you have a bio that says you do.
And now, there you go. It took years to get there, but here we are. So yeah, I mean, it became a question of, all right, you've been at the State Department for a year and a half. Yeah. Have you figured out the building enough to determine what work needs to be done, who to do it with, convince them to do it, et cetera? And it was a great challenge. Mm-hmm. So I would say the work really started with building a vast network of officers across our functional and regional bureaus. So those are the people who work on specific topics, as well as people who work on just everything going on in each geopolitical region of the world, figuring out what work they already do and how the gender climate topic mm-hmm. naturally slots into what they're already doing, right. And then figuring out what tools and resources and information and support they would need to do gender climate work in the context of their ongoing efforts. So right. For those who are unfamiliar, I could talk about the gender climate nexus forever. I won't. I'll do the quick version. But basically, it boils down to the fact that in many parts of the world, women and girls are disproportionately and uniquely impacted by the effects of climate change because of their roles in the home, in mm-hmm. society, the types of jobs they have access to, et cetera. And at the same time, women and girls are often some of the people developing the most creative and innovative solutions to address climate challenges. And yet they're not often given access to the spaces like the mm-hmm. entrepreneurial tools, the finance, the credit, the decision-making tables to see those solutions come to fruition. So it became my job to figure out ways in which to address the challenges, promote the opportunities in yeah. the context of food systems, water security, migration, conflict, gender-based violence, green and blue economies, women in STEM, yeah. you name it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, so I was lucky enough to actually sit in at least one, maybe more than one course at Foreign Service Institute, where you mm-hmm. came in as the expert to talk about the gender climate nexus. And one or two of the things that you said that really stuck with me were, first of all, the fact that the reason that women and girls are often on the front lines of climate adaptation and mitigation is because necessity is the mother of invention. And they're the ones that mm-hmm. are most impacted often by
yep.
climate change. Two, the fact that the focus is not only on viewing women and girls as victims of the elevated risk of climate change, but as agents of change in their own communities. Yes. Like their agency, their ability to be supported and to be active in engineering solutions, I think is so inspiring. And so then you started something called Innovation Station. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's honestly one of my proudest accomplishments at State. So the Innovation Station was really my way of putting into practice a term that you hear all the time at, mm-hmm. at the State Department, which was amplifying the voices of mm-hmm. people, right? And I was always like, what do you mean by that? Like, okay, you're letting them speak, but like, that's great. I mean, we should put a spotlight on people doing good work, but is that the end of the story? Is that really right. as impactful as it could be? And so Innovation Station was born out of COVID times when people were really starting to embrace like virtual conferences, webinars, things like that, and the power of using those sorts of virtual technologies to connect people from the United States with people all around the world.
Yeah.
So with the Innovation Station at its core was a five-year initiative to identify a network of women and girls developing creative, translatable solutions to climate and sustainability challenges, and not just amplify them through various communications tools, including podcasts, virtual mm-hmm. events, and newsletters, et cetera, but to take things one step further and then use the audiences for those virtual platforms to pick out strategic new relationships for the women right. and girls being featured, right? Yeah. And to help them connect with those individuals, those representatives of communities all across the United States and around the world where the women's solutions, whether that's data collection or a program, an initiative, a technology, could potentially be deployed to address whatever challenge their mm-hmm. their innovation is meant to address. And so through that initiative, I was able to help more than 170 women who ended up in the network build more than 1,500 new collaborative relationships.
That's amazing.
And nothing was more exciting to me than hearing success stories of like, oh, you know, we met and we had this conversation and now they joined my board, or, mm-hmm. you know, now I'm selling my product in Mumbai or what have you, you know?
Yeah.
And one of the things that is most disappointing, I think, about the fact that I no longer work at the State Department, and the fact that the Innovation Station is now kind of on indefinite hiatus at the State yeah. Department, is the fact that 80% of the women in the Innovation Station network were American women, because mm-hmm. part of the goal behind the initiative was to spotlight American best practices and create opportunities for American women around the world. And so I feel like that actually really would have fit well with yeah. the priorities, the America First priorities that we currently are witnessing. And I'm just sad that it's no longer, you know, that the initiative is no longer operating.
Yeah, that is sad. And so many initiatives no longer operating. And I yeah. think you make a really great point about the fact that like we can help women in other countries and help American women at the same time, because we're building mm-hmm. these like robust partnerships mm-hmm. and women's economic empowerment mm-hmm. also increases stability and builds resilient communities and reduces yeah. violence and like addresses so many of the things that we need to address all at the same time. It's not just because yeah. it's a nice thing to do.
Right. And it's strategic. That's
a really important thing. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So you've done a million and one things, so we could spend the whole episode talking about your work, but then we wouldn't ever get to talk about you, and I really feel like I want to talk about you a little bit more
sure.
too. So as someone who is so invested in their work and been, like, by all objective measures, so successful in your career so far, how have you maintained a really strong sense of self in your career rather than getting swallowed up by any part of it, which I think is really easy to do in public service?
Especially at a place like the State Department, where you don't often get a full sense of ownership over the mm-hmm. work that you're doing. I mean, we are most of the time nameless and faceless, mm-hmm. right? Like, there's a reason why you go on the State Department website and you're not going to find like an employee list, really, mm-hmm. like, or like, oh, here's this office, here's everyone in the office. It doesn't work like that. So I think I would have had a much harder time maintaining that sense of self if I was on one of those portfolios where I was just jumping on to continue the work.
Yeah.
I, in addition to the rare opportunity of developing my own portfolio at State, I was also given a pretty rare opportunity to kind of be the face of that work in most contexts.
Wait, which I pause. You weren't just mm-hmm. given the opportunity, though. You earned the opportunity. Like, I feel like
oh.
people might not know how much hard work and networking and how many steps that I think that you took that others may not have taken.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah, but
you
go
know,
ahead.
No, that's really interesting to think of it that way. You're making me think about it differently, and I really appreciate that. Because you're right. I think part of being given or earning that opportunity mm-hmm. is having people trust you
yes.
to deliver yes. the message, and it takes building those networks in a place like the State Department.
1,000%.
I think we're also around a lot of people who don't want their face on things because they're afraid of, you know, they're afraid of that. I have fortunately never had that problem. I'm like, I'm everywhere. Let me do whatever.
Yes. But sorry, I derailed you. Go back to what you were saying.
No, it's totally fine. It's totally fine. I mean, it's just the fact that like I, from the get-go, I walked in and I was like, I want to write blogs for the department and I want my name on it instead of the director of the office's name on it. Like, I'm not yeah. ghostwriting for this person. Mm. If it's my thoughts, it's my name. And then like when we turned Innovation Station into a thing, I was like, I want to moderate the session, the events. I want to host the podcast. I have podcasting experience, so you can mm-hmm. trust me to do this. That was a big one, getting the Public Affairs Bureau to let me make a podcast, because
yeah.
State's still kind of behind. So
it's hard
I
to even
think,
get approved to be on a podcast, much less
right.
make a new one.
Exactly. And so having these conversations to build the relationships to let me do some of the outward facing work with my name and my face, I think really helped me build my sense of self and an identity within the foreign policy sphere related to gender and climate change.
Yeah.
Beyond that, though, I just think not losing yourself in the work really requires you to have things that you care about outside of work.
Yeah.
And I know we're going to talk about National Treasure Hunt. We can get to that. But for me, that was one of the reasons I started that project, was because during COVID, I found myself never logging off of the work email. And not knowing what else to do with my time and finding myself falling into this pit of I am my job. Mm-hmm. And so having those outside activities, whether it's an entrepreneurial project, a creative project, a family slash kids, like whatever that is, I think is the importance cannot be overstated.
Yeah, I fully agree. And we will get to National Treasure Hunt because I really want to talk about that. But before we do, I have one more question related to the work. What, you know, so first of all, you are now separated from the department. You received a RIF notice along with so many other people a couple of weeks ago. And I want to give you space to say anything you'd like to say about that, about how that happened or how you feel about that. And then lead us into, if you had a magic wand, what would you change in order to make the practice of our democracy and our and the connections between American people and our policymakers stronger?
Ooh, that's
I'm sorry, that's a
biggie.
Lot, I know. But I'm giving you space to dodge something if you want to.
This is how I know you worked at the State Department. Like, you have the unstated media training. So I kind of think there are a million ways to answer this question, and I'm going to try to give an answer that maybe you haven't heard before, your audience hasn't heard before, since I'm sure some of the other things I would say others have probably said way more eloquently than I would. I think that something the State Department had always done fairly well was really respecting people of different educational backgrounds and different areas of expertise coming in, and like you said earlier, Kate, finding ways to apply that knowledge and their personal way of thinking to different problem sets at a place like the State Department. I can't tell you how many people ask me, like, what from your science background most directly like translates to your work at the State Department? And I was like, honestly, almost none of the technical stuff. It's the way of thinking that's different, the way of problem solving. And I do fear that we are getting to a point with the layoffs, with the reduction in force, that we're going to be kind of siloing the expertise that people have, or like the educational backgrounds and expertise people have, into little pockets that don't allow that same sort of interdisciplinary thinking and application of ways of thought. Like, I think there was a huge value in having a scientist do gender climate work for the last 4 years.
Yes.
I think the work would have looked super different if you had brought in a human rights person. And I don't know that it necessarily would have been better or worse. It would have been different.
Right.
And there's value in that. And so making sure that you're able to recruit people of all different backgrounds, whether those are educational backgrounds, you know, your major, for lack of a better term, or demographic backgrounds, where you're coming from in the country, all of that, I think, is so important. And I do worry, between the layoffs and the new parameters that are being put in place for hiring, as well as the hiring freeze that is ongoing, like, I'm concerned about that. And what I will say about the reductions in force is just that it's really sad to see thousands of years of expertise in various facets of foreign policy just disappeared. That is expertise that you cannot replace overnight. You cannot replace in a decade, maybe even longer. And I'm hopeful that all those folks find new wonderful places to land, but I also know that it's a challenging time in the job market. So
you know, when you talked about like having people bring their own backgrounds and having like a scientist work on gender policy, like that's how new little thought babies are born. You have to bring together different ideas to make new ideas. And I always kind of enjoyed being the outlier in a room. Like if you're someone who loves to work on gender issues, it can be amazing to go and work on a team that's looking at gender issues. But personally, I would rather be the only person with gender expertise in the room who can then be like, here's a new idea, because this is a space where maybe the thoughts are most valuable and not already present. You know what I mean? And so I
definitely do.
The experience might have been similar for you, like coming from working in a science office to being the science person in a non-scientific office. I feel like that must have been really interesting.
Absolutely. And I like what you said about like how bringing together people of different ilks like creates new ideas. And the tough thing about convincing people of that is it's really hard to quantify, right? I can tell you what happened because I was in my position, but I can't tell you what would have happened if someone else was. And so it makes it hard to convince people who don't necessarily want to embrace that interdisciplinary thinking. It's hard to convince them why they should without those sorts of, you know, tangible comparisons, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, and some things lend themselves really well to measurement and others don't. And that's exactly why we have anecdotal evidence. And that's why we have this podcast.
Yay.
Okay. Now we have to talk about National Treasure Hunt because it's so cool. It's a podcast, a book, you have events, you do so many things with this. So talk about where this idea came from and what you're up to now.
Yeah. So National Treasure Hunt has been entirely in my personal capacity. But basically, I don't know. Are you familiar with the National Treasure movies, Kate? Like Nick Cage, I'm going to steal the Declaration. Okay, great.
Of course. I'm obsessed.
You have excellent taste.
Maybe not as obsessed as you, but I do love them.
It has become my whole personality. So basically, early in the COVID years, my former college roommate and I, Ursinus, it's all, I tell you, Ursinus is the reason for everything. My former roommate and I reconnected. We're both scientists by training. We hadn't spoken for many years as we were individually pursuing our graduate school degrees, but I was in the shower one day. You know how these stories start. And I was listening to a podcast about another podcast. And that podcast was, I guess, like the host was like, yeah, I have a whole series about the Back to the Future movies. And I was like, whoa. I'm pretty sure there are only three of those movies. If this guy can do a whole podcast about this franchise, my former roommate and I could totally do a podcast about National Treasure. So I called her. Her name's Emily. I called Emily. She picked up the phone probably because she thought I was dying because we hadn't spoken in so long.
And you're and I was still like dripping wet from the shower.
Literally, literally. I was like, hi, hear me out. She's like, are you okay? I'm like, we're about to be great. So that's how it started. I convinced her we started a podcast for fun. The whole premise was like National Treasure is a deceptively complex franchise. Like there's a mm-hmm. lot of disciplines, history, science, ethics, all kinds of stuff that goes into it. And we can assess all of those areas and more. And so that's how it began. We learned very quickly that there was an even bigger fan community than we realized that was like hungry for this sort of content. And that's how we branched off into other projects as well. So we launched a walking tour in Washington, D.C. that runs twice a year. Which is basically a, like walking around the National Mall and talking about the history of the mall, but also how that history plays into National Treasure, the behind the scenes of filming right here in DC that happened in the early 2000s. That's super fun. We love the tour. People have come from all across the country to do it. We published our first book in 2023, which is basically a scene-by-scene analysis of both films. It's kind of bringing the podcast into written form. I have a new book coming out in May of 2026, which is basically inspired by the character Riley Poole's book in the second movie, kind of looking at different historical mysteries and legends and our current understanding of those tales. And how, if at all, they could play into a future of the National Treasure franchise. And then finally, we started a big event series where we kind of travel all around. Definitely, we've done a lot at the Mid-Atlantic, but we're starting to go all across the country giving lectures and these super fun interactive events called Heist Nights that kind of teach people through an interdisciplinary lens about, you know, history, science, ciphers, yeah, and film production, like in the movies.
This is so cool. Is your goal to just like get people thinking differently and to inspire kind of them?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a couple goals. It's an edutainment project. So it's, yeah, like teaching people things while they're like having fun. It's like sneaky, like you don't realize you're learning something. But it's also, I think, to build community in a mm-hmm. world that is increasingly divisive.
Yeah.
Something that I find so unique about National Treasure is, and I cannot think of another movie that does this genuinely. Mm-hmm. It attracts fans and viewers from all walks of life, all parts of the political spectrum. You, yeah, see when big moments are happening in our nation's history, you see people on social media quoting Ben Gates, Nick Cage's, yeah, character, in the context of being pro something and in the context of being anti something. Same, yeah, quote. Different people using the same quote to motivate their beliefs. Isn't, yeah, that interesting? And so it's like you can use that premise in a way to try to build bridges between people of different belief systems mm-hmm. if they are already converging over the fact that they relate to this noble character. Well, if I think I'm noble and you think you're noble because we can both relate to this character, but we have yeah. very different beliefs, clearly we share some value. What is yeah. that value? Why can we yeah. relate over this character? So that's kind of the ethereal bigger picture motivation.
Yeah, it's so interesting too, because I think it gets back to the root of our national identity, and people mm. really want to feel connected to a sense of that identity and also to feel proud or inspired or motivated by some facet of it. And like you're yeah. saying, there are so many different ways people can go with this because the franchise has such broad appeal. But I love anything that can bring people together and build community. And I think it's so cool that you found this way to do that through something that you're really passionate about. So like, obviously mm-hmm. it's organic for you. It's not like you're pretending to be really into National Treasure to do
it. Right, that. Right.
If so, that would be a ton of time and energy sunk into something. Also, I think it's mind blowing that you've built all of this. I'm like taking notes because I'm like, okay, I have to ask her how she did that after her podcast. You know, I'm taking notes for myself selfishly, but also to do all of that in your personal time while standing up a brand new government strategy during your day job. Like, I don't understand when you rest. Do you rest?
I honestly do. I feel like I typically get a good 8 hours around that. And I also watch a decent amount of TV. You'd be surprised, man. But I don't know. I just work. I feel like when I have more things to do, I work more efficiently writ large.
Yeah.
And so you can get more done. Most of the National Treasure Hunt stuff has happened in the evenings. Like my mm-hmm. Emily and I have weekly or biweekly meetings for recordings, for business, etc. But it has been really fun. One of the things that I've enjoyed most from like a personal level with National Treasure Hunt, besides like meeting a whole new community and building a community, is all the things that I have learned and have had to teach myself, because I had had some prior podcasting experience before National Treasure Hunt, but like publishing a book or like, I mean, we have a small business. Like, what does that look like? What do taxes for a small business look like? You know, how do you partner with museums to put on events?
Right.
You know, things that I think a manager would typically do for many people, and doing all that work myself, I feel like I've learned so much. I'm genuinely proud of it. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. Maybe also the fact that you're so interdisciplinary and you're thinking, it means that like you're never just doing one thing. You're always thinking yeah. multiple thoughts and seeing the connections between things. And that's actually remarkably efficient if you can harness it. I feel like that's what you've done.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I'm not going to lie. There were moments before I knew I would not be at the State Department anymore where I was like, well, what could I do for America 250 at the State Department, given all of my connections with the National Archives and the Library of Congress right. and Independence Hall and, you know, things like that.
Which could have been really cool and they effed up. But you know what? You're going to do amazing things either way. And I am just so thankful that you've joined me for this project. We've talked about so many things here. Is there anything, like last word, anything that you really want people like you who had no idea what the State Department was about to know about the foreign policy community? What do you want people to know?
You know, I think it's really important, and especially as people outside of DC are hearing these news stories about like, the Office of Global Women's Issues was closed. The Trafficking in Persons Office was closed. The Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor mm-hmm. Bureau was slashed. Those are all just words to people who don't live and work here. And so it can be hard, especially in the human rights space, whether it's women's rights or otherwise, to understand how work at the State Department directly affects you and I here sitting in the mm-hmm. United States, or someone in Iowa or Texas mm-hmm. or New Jersey or wherever. And I would just say, like, trust me. I know you've known me for all of 5 minutes, but trust me when I say that, you know, there are many things that the State Department does that directly increases or improves our safety and security when it comes to things like how we work through passport control or diplomatic security mm-hmm. or migration issues, et cetera. But many things that the State Department has historically done and hopefully will continue to do that are just as valuable, they're longer term investments. Like, there are reasons we have foreign assistance programming funds that, in our case, like empowered women entrepreneurs in all different parts of the world, or helped to combat gender-based violence in other contexts, etc. Because frankly, to put it as bluntly as I can, we are a very wealthy country. And doing things to help people in other parts of the world that make those people trust and like the United States mm-hmm. is a good thing. That mm-hmm. affords longer term security that those migration efforts, those diplomatic yeah. security efforts, et cetera, can't necessarily give us. We're looking at things right. that counter people developing negative views of the United States, countering them
yeah.
potentially wanting to do us harm down the line.
Right. Hearts and minds.
Hearts and minds. And so just because we can't show you, you know, in a like time capsule, like, hey, look to 20 years from now, mm-hmm. there's proof that what this human rights work did mattered to keep us yeah. safer. You gotta trust that the people who have worked in this space are doing this because it's going to have that long-term impact. And I sincerely hope we can all get on board with this work continuing immediately and down the line.
Yeah, perfect summary. And I just want to thank you one more time for joining me on the show, for being such a good friend and thought partner across several years now. And I really look forward to seeing everything that you do in the future and supporting you in your amazing, unpredictable projects that you take on. So thank you for being here. But also, Aubrey, thank you so much for your service to our country.
Well, thank you, Kate, for yours as well and for having me. And finally, congratulations on the incredible podcast.
Well, thank you. I learned from the best.